Good evening. Last time I was here, someone asked me if the next time I came I would talk about anger. And I will. In fact, it seems like a very appropriate time to talk about anger. So the reason someone asked me to do this is I was talking about another topic, and I had just published a book on if you are in a very painful situation, catastrophic loss or physical disability, that you need to cultivate pleasure. And I wrote a book about the different aspects of pleasure. And one of them is a really effective way to express rage and bitterness. Because if you have great loss or have chronic pain, you will be bitter. You will be angry. And actually, everybody has this problem to some degree or another, so it's very important to have a way to deal with this. So that's the point of view from which I was talking before. But all that's in the book. What I'd rather talk about tonight is just generally the ninth bodhisattva grave precept, which is, according to Thich Nhat Hanh, not harboring ill will. Robert Aiken calls it not indulging in anger. I call it not taking refuge in hatred. Not taking refuge in hatred. That means that you don't use hatred as the ground of being to like occupy yourself or make yourself feel a certain way or make yourself feel self-righteous or whatever. So I wanted to talk about this tonight. Actually, I'm willing to talk about it anytime. But I think it's a very big problem, anger and ill will and hatred for people in a spiritual pursuit, or in any idealistic pursuit. First of all, you get involved in a sangha, or in green politics, or in an anti-war movement, a peace movement, any of those. Most people do that out of their desire to serve and make the world a better place, to help others. That's why most people do that sort of thing. So then it's very disconcerting to hate your coworkers, to hate everybody else who's with you in the peace movement, the green politics, the sangha, and even if you manage not to hate everybody who's working with you, then there's still us and them, the people who aren't in the movement, the people who are causing the problem in the first place by not recycling or whatever. So that's always an issue, and it's very disconcerting. It's very upsetting to dedicate your life in this way and then to have this come up. So I think that it's a very good koan to deal with is, how does the Buddha get angry? And I spent 7 years of my life with that koan. I found it very helpful. First of all, I want to talk about and define, for the purposes of the talk tonight, ill will and anger, because I think there's a big difference between them. Ill will, I think of as that kind of resentment, seething, fermenting kind of cold rage that comes from humiliation often. It exists in the shadow world. If you carry this around for a long time, you will come to know the shadow world. This is the kind of stuff that fuels what is known as black magic. You know, because this is ill will, if you stay with it for a long period of time and look at the world through this lens, it is a kind of samadhi. It is a kind of samadhi. And you'll start to notice hurtful things. You'll start to concentrate on that sort of thing. So in that way, it fuels black magic. And it certainly poisons an atmosphere a particular space. Like if a landlord evicts you and you continue to live there, say you have a 90-day eviction notice, the atmosphere is probably poisoned by his feelings, his or her feelings, and your feelings. Anyway, there are many situations you can think of in which just ill will as a stance, as a point of view, poisons the whole atmosphere. Everybody's energy is drained. Everybody who walks into the atmosphere feels bad, whether they're a party to the situation or not. So this is the kind of hatred that eats at you. This is the kind of hatred that is biochemically destructive. So if you live with ill will for a long period of time, you usually begin to have physical symptoms, or it has physical ramifications because it is so destructive biochemically to have this constant feeling of tight, cold rage. So I think that ill will is a big problem that you have to solve. Now, anger, on the other hand, I'd like to distinguish that. I think of that as kind of hot, explosive, potentially violent, but basically explosive. And in that sense, it's a kind of pure energy. It's just tremendously energetic. And you can do good or ill with anger. It's not like ill will. You can do good or ill. And where ill will is cold, anger is hot. For instance, righteous anger fuels social action. But self-righteousness actually hinders effective social action. So you have to know where you are. So before I talk very specifically about anger and ill will, I'd like to point out the conditions that are necessary for ill will and anger to arise, because these are very useful to you in trying to figure out how you're going to live with one or both. First of all, what's necessary for ill will or anger to arise is that you have an idea of how something should be and it gets violated. That's the basic condition. So it means that you have some kind of hard corner there, that something bumps up against. So you have to find a reference. If you want to kind of dispel this, you have to find a reference point that's wider than the idea that you had. For instance, I can be standing in a line at the grocery store, and it seems like most people know exactly how much space there's supposed to be between the people. But occasionally a person won't regard that and they'll come too close to me and I'll just have this incredible rage. I mean, it's just bang. It's set off immediately. And when I feel this, then I try to widen my point of view. It may be that this person is from a culture that doesn't think a foot and a half exactly is the amount of space to have between people, or that person is distracted thinking about something else. So I widen that, and it helps. It helps dispel it a little bit. So this condition, this idea that you have that's violated, it can be a wholesome idea. For instance, if you see a mother slap her child in the grocery store, the idea you have that's violated of a child should not be slapped, that's a wholesome idea. It is correct, in a sense, in this particular instance, for you to feel that. It's wholesome for you to feel that and then decide what you're going to do. Or it can be an unwholesome idea, like the thing I said, you know, very arbitrary, the space between people at the store. Or you see, just something you don't like, something that's aesthetically not pleasing, or somebody honks their horn and you'd like it to be quiet. So you have to always be aware when these feelings arise in you of the idea that you have that's being violated. So the reason you want to be, if you're practicing, the reason you want to be aware of your idea that led to this, to the arising of anger, is because usually we hold this idea and separate out reality according to our self-interest. And you should know what that is. What is the idea you have that's in your self-interest? Because in the primordial non-dual experience that we have, before the subject-object split, there's no reason to be angry. It's all one. There's no reason for anger or ill will to arise because there's no separating out. So you can do what is appropriate in that realm without anger. For instance, if you don't see the mother and the child in the grocery store as different from you, then it's possible for you to go over to the mother and say, "Could I take care of your child for you while you shop? You know, would that be helpful to you at all?" So that you're actually moving into the situation without anger. So that's just, I'm not holding that up as something you should do. Maybe you should haul off and hit her. She'd remember that. I'm just saying that it's very good to see your reaction against a non-dual background. So that, again, this widens your perspective. Often people don't realize that many of these problems caused by anger boil down to a simple choice. To just say, what's important here? What's the important thing in this situation in which my idea has been violated? So to discuss ill will for a little bit, this is ongoing resentment over violation of one's opinions. And as I said, it's very hard on the body. So if you have long-term ill will toward a person, a government, you know, just generally, you should probably try to heal it. Try to figure out how to heal it. Figure out what's in you, what idea you have that's being violated, just for your own health and the well-being of the entire world. For instance, I'll give you an example from my own life. Our landlord did evict us in San Francisco, and he was very clear. He wanted to evict us because we were on rent control, and he wanted to raise the rent to about four times what it was. So he gave us a long time to move out. He didn't exactly evict us because that's illegal, but I won't go into how it was done. So I think we had about 8 months. So we decided to stay in this cheap apartment for the 8 months and take that 8 months to do what we had to do. There were a number of units in our family unit that all had to go their separate ways. So at first, the three adults involved, my husband and I and my son, at first we would just make jokes about our landlord, you know, nasty, really nasty jokes, calling them the Uber Lords and, you know, making any reference to Nazi Germany that we could. And we are all really nasty people. We had really good jokes. But I must tell you that every time we did this, I felt funny. I felt like my energy was leaking a little bit. I mean, I just had that small little perception. And it just felt like losing a little energy. I didn't object from any moral grounds. I'm not really a moral person. I mean, it's not the realm I live in. But I just felt, you know, a little energy leak every time we would, you know, make jokes and go, you know, about them, our landlords. Finally, one day I was struggling up the front steps with my suitcase, and one of them, the wife, offered to help. And she took my suitcase up to the landing and right by my door, And so when I got inside the door, I said to my husband, that does it. I am not going to talk about them anymore. We're villainizing them, you know, on all fronts, and it just doesn't feel good. And he said, I'm so glad you said that. I'm really glad, because I haven't felt comfortable doing it either. So the funny thing, the result of that deciding not to do it, and just whenever it came up, just not going there, was, in a funny way, the black magic that was there in the house lifted. I mean, that was there in the hallway there. I could tell when I stepped out on the landing that they were waiting for me to leave before they would leave. And, you know, it's just impossible to live for a long period of time with that bad feeling. And after I stopped doing that, it lifted for us. And what happened is I then put that energy into asserting ourselves. I mean, it was just amazing what happened. Part of the reason we joked about them and felt so bad is they were renovating the other apartments that they'd kicked the other people out of while we were still there. We were the last family, and it made a terrible noise, even after working hours. So I just went and said, this is very inconsiderate. It may be legal, but it's not humane. Please don't do this after 4:30. And he said, oh, you're right, I won't. So, you know, here all that energy that I was putting into nasty jokes, I was able to use to actually push him back a little and make our lives more livable while we were there. So this is what I mean about ill will. It's very poisonous. You have to dispel it some way. And I think there are many ways to do this. I think physical exertion is one way. I think service, being a volunteer in some way, widens your view. It just frees up all that energy that you're putting in a certain way. Now, I'd much rather talk about anger, actually, because it's much more interesting and much more complicated. As I said, it can be used for good or for ill, that energy of anger. So the basic question about anger is whether to express or suppress in any given situation. And I'm not one to ever tell people to jump to their higher selves about anger. I think it's a terrible thing to do. And by jumping to the higher self, I mean that when you feel violated or angry, you immediately say, well, I'm getting upset over nothing. In 10 years, what will this mean? Or, yes, they probably had some reason to do this. Or blah, blah, blah. So that you cut off that energy. You cut it off immediately. It's very uncomfortable anger. So it makes some kind of, you know, intuitive sense to cut it off. You don't want to feel it. But actually, it's much better to feel it and to consciously decide what to do with it. To express it, many ways to do that, or suppress it. And by suppress it, I mean take the anger, feel it through your body, and decide not to act on it. So with full consciousness, you're feeling it, but you're putting it aside. In fact, Mark Epstein has a wonderful phrase for putting emotions aside that you're feeling but decide not to act on. He calls it putting them in meditative equipoise so that you can inspect them and look at them. And this dealing with anger, whether you're going to allow anger in the moment or allow it at some time or suppress it, this takes a lot of skill. You actually have to experiment and develop skill. So it makes sense to put it in meditative equipoise sometimes so that you can investigate it yourself and the situation. So in deciding whether to express or suppress, because anger can be either very creative and valuable or very abusive and violent, I think that we grope here toward the middle way. And the middle way is nowhere standing. In other words, you don't have a stance. You don't have a fixed point of view about what to do with anger. You do the much riskier thing, which is to judge a situation on its merits when you're in the situation. This is terrifying until you do it thousands of times, and get to know what you're like, get to know how other people react. So you practice the middle way because sometimes energy is very valuable in practice. It can really drive practice creatively. You get impatient, or your teacher gets impatient with you, or you get impatient with your students. You know, if you get to know yourself and know what makes you impatient, you usually can trust that feeling. If you get to know and don't give into it immediately, you study it over a period of time, you can start to trust yourself. If I'm getting impatient, that must mean I've been pushed once too often. Well, by definition. So it's very important to decide what to do in a situation, to judge a particular situation on its merits, because the consequences of bottling up anger or spending it unwisely are dire. They're very dire. It's similar to karma with sex. Carelessness can be long-lasting and harmful. So you need to figure this out. So because it's so fluid and so different from situation to situation, I think you have to, if you're a practicing person, give yourself permission to experiment with it. And I have some guidelines to present to you for that experimentation. One is decide to do no harm. That's the basic Buddhist guideline, to do no harm. So that means that you understand that unexpressed anger, unfelt anger, repressed anger, as opposed to suppressed, you consciously decide to put it aside. That means that repressed anger leads to passive aggression. So if you jump to your higher self, don't feel the anger, that means that you'll come back like a scorpion's tail and you'll hurt the person indirectly. Excuse me, since we're both in the same sangha together, I thought I'd give you some helpful feedback. What? I didn't mean to hurt you. I'm sorry if you can't take the truth. That kind of thing. And you render the person powerless to engage with you or connect with you because you're not copping to it. You're not copping to your anger. So you can't practice with anger until you feel it, until you're in it, until you're feeling it. And then when you feel the feeling, you can investigate it. But you have to feel it first. You can't change it into something else. And that's why it took me so long, the 7 years of practicing with how the Buddha gets angry, because I had to find my anger first before I got murdered by someone who objected to my passive aggression. So the first rule is do no harm. So I did have a period of time when I was practicing with this koan in which I permitted myself temper tantrums. And this is because I know some of you have no trouble with temper tantrums. In fact, you want to not have temper tantrums. But I come from the opposite end of the scale in that I couldn't find my anger. I had so repressed, suppressed, pushed it away that I had to find it first. So when I found it, I was so happy that I thought, well, why don't I experiment with temper tantrums? Why don't I just have a temper tantrum whenever I get angry? And so I made a couple of rules for myself. I think the first person that I had a temper tantrum with was a man on the street who I don't know what exactly. I won't go into the details. But anyway, he started hitting me. Oh, he said something to me, and I replied, and then he started hitting me. And I thought, this isn't good. So we won't do this again. We won't, when somebody's already angry, we won't come back with something that ups the ante. So I decided on a couple of rules that I would never have temper tantrums with children, on children, no children. No situations in which there was unequal power and I had more power, like teacher-student would be an example, or employer-employee would be an example. Never have a temper tantrum on somebody who had less power. And then, obviously, not on any helpless person. Although it's very tempting to have a temper tantrum with people who irritate you on the street, like homeless people or whatever, it is off limits. At least I made it off limits for myself because, I mean, it's just not fair. It's not right. You won't feel right if you do that. And so I found myself after some months of practicing this just mainly having temper tantrums with people who are specially trained to deal with them, like supervisors, managers of large department stores, and at that time, airline personnel. I think it'll be a while before I have a temper tantrum in an airport. So these were the situations that I chose to permit myself if it so happened that I got that angry, that I would feel it rise, and then I'd think, is this a situation in which I can just keep going, or do I have to put the brakes on now? And I would, in some situations, go for it and just have the temper tantrum. Sometimes I was cheered on in a bank once. And of course, at gates and airports, everybody always, you're voicing what they feel. But then other times I had people just look at me like, get the nut out of here. And very often supervisors, actually, this worked out very well because supervisors have the satisfaction then of the feeling that they've dealt well with the crazy one by giving them what they want. So I don't do this anymore, but this was a phase I went through for a couple of years. I'm talking to you about experimenting. So you can do this kind of thing and see how you feel about it, how other people react to it. It's part of the whole gestalt of how does the Buddha get angry? How do you deal with, if you already are a person who has temper tantrums all the time, I would experiment with meditative equipoise. So, actually, the body is where to go with anger. The body is where to go. It's the first place that I looked when I tried to find my anger. Because not only is the body registering violation of your idea or some wrong that you've been done, but it's the place where that processes, too. It's very fluid, especially if you do a practice, some kind of meditation practice. Your body has open spaces in it that will process this stuff. You don't even have to worry about it. You just let your body feel it and notice what's happening. So your body is definitely a place to go to do this. So the first guideline is do no harm. The second one is accept full responsibility for your anger, for any situation in which there's anger. Avoid blaming mentality, because you never learn anything from blaming anybody, the media or the government, and they might deserve it all. 99% of it might be the media's fault, the government's fault, your friend's fault, your coworker's fault. But if even 1% is yours, or just assume it's yours, even if you don't, even if somebody is totally projected onto you, what was it about you that they projected this onto? If you just assume that it's your fault and accept responsibility, you'll learn a lot. And what's more important, your practice or who's right or wrong? So, to give you an example again from my own life, when I was leading a practice period at Zen Center in the summer, I used to go from a class to a student tea around 5 o'clock on Wednesday, and it was very hard for people to come to that tea, students to come, because, you know, had to get off work early, blah, 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 get through traffic and be there at 5 o'clock. And I am very punctual. I mean, I'm pathologically punctual, I think, because I have a lot of anxiety about being late. And so I would walk in the door of Zen Center, start toward the tee, and then have people stop me and ask me questions. So getting from the door to the room where the tee was held always took about 10 or 15 minutes. Well, one time as I sat down 10 or 15 minutes late, I think it was about 10 minutes this time, a student, the practice period was about the precepts, and a student said in a passive-aggressive way, she said, "Is it a violation of the precept of not stealing for a teacher to be 10 minutes late to a tea that other people have tried to get to?" So immediately, rage! All her faults swam before my eyes. And just the pithiest, perfect little remark and reply rose, and then I thought, unequal power situation. Cannot do this. Absolutely can't do this. So I apologized for being late. And then the next time I came to Zen Center. Oh, and I had to, once I got to the car after the tea, I had to say, "You were late. You cannot deny this. You can't think just because you wanted to be on time and you arrived in order to be on time, you weren't on time. You can't assume you are blameless." The next time I arrived 15 minutes early to accommodate all the questions and everything and got to the place on time. So you have, it really helps to accept responsibility. It really helps dispel what's going on. And then the most important guideline, I think, is you can work on softening yourself while at the same time that you're acquiring skills, that you're experimenting and acquiring skills. And the particular skills you want to acquire and cultivate take a long time to do, like cultivating patience through zazen and mindfulness, through meditation and mindfulness. That takes a long time, years, for that kind of practice to make a lot of difference. And also, you need to be accessible to other people's feedback and actively solicit it from your friends, your boss, your coworkers, your Sangha members, especially your Sangha members, because they're in the same boat. You know, this is not a social relationship, a room full of social relationships. There might be incidental social relationships or social relationships that brought other people here, but the purpose of this group is not social. It's not based on attraction or aversion like social relationships are. It's based on a mutual respect for other people who are practicing. So this is your group to solicit feedback from. Did I handle that? Do you think I handled that situation all right? Or the situation I had with you that I have to work out with you, how do you feel about that? I'm practicing with anger. I'm trying to figure out how to use it, how to channel it, how to act. So to actively solicit, but also to soften yourself at the same time. So again, I'll give you an example. When I was a much younger student, many years ago, when I lived at Green Gulch, and my teacher, Richard Baker Roshi, called me into Doksan one time, and he said, you know, I'd really like to give you a lot of responsibility. You know, I'd really like to train you, you know, to take responsibility for other people's practice. But every time I bring this up, you know, to other elders in the community, people put you down. They say, you're not ready for this. You're too arrogant. You're too this. You're too that. And he said, At first I used to listen to that, but now I think a couple people, you've pissed off a couple of people, and they have grudges against you. So I think that you ought to address that. And he said, here's what you'll do. And he named the two people. He said, you go to them and you say that I told you that you were to come and find out what was wrong with you. And while they're telling you, don't say a word in your defense. Just take it in. Don't say a word. I said, oh my God, all right. So I went to the first person, because the second person was truly terrifying. I went to the first person and I said, I want to meet with you because Baker Roshi said that you had a lot of criticism of me, and I'd like to know what I did and how you see this, what the problem is. So he started off with great energy telling me, you know, what I had done in this situation when I worked. Well, he's somebody I had worked with. And what I'd done here, what I'd do there. And he just kept going and going. And then he kind of interrupted himself. I said nothing. He said, but then you were really having a hard time then, weren't you? You know, you were breaking up with your husband and you were pregnant. And he said, maybe that's why you did the things you did. I said nothing. He said, gee, I guess maybe you were doing pretty well given your circumstances. Okay, that was him. Okay, then I went to her. And she really let me have it. She took up a whole afternoon and men. Then she made an appointment to continue the next day. It was tough. And then she ended up my friend. You know, the same process. I wept and cried because she was brutal. I mean, I didn't want to be the kind of person she was describing. And, but it ended up with her befriending me and fighting for me at these meetings. So, it really changes the way the dust swirls if you are genuinely interested in practice rather than who's right. If you genuinely want to experiment with this part of you instead of sweeping it under the rug. It's very important to use this energy. And I'll give Thich Nhat Hanh the last word because I very much like what he says. He says, treat your anger with the utmost respect and tenderness, for it is no other than yourself. Do not suppress it, simply be aware of it. Awareness is like the sun. When it shines on things, they are transformed. When you're aware that you're angry, your anger is transformed. If you destroy anger, you destroy the Buddha. For Buddha and Mara are of the same essence. Mindfully dealing with anger is like taking the hand of a little brother. Are there any questions? Yes.
The question is, how do you handle being on the other end of anger? And the reason that I think it's important is if we are going to practice and experiment in whatever way we have, if we have suppressed our anger, we experiment with expressing it. We express it too much, we experiment with concentration. We're likely to be wrong. Some of that experience, we may encounter a person who has just had a loss, Maybe they're considering suicide, or maybe their dog died that morning. You just never know what's going on the other end. So, given that we live in the world and this happens anyway, do you have any suggestions when you're on the other end of it and you're just miserable? I mean, you had good intention, or you were misunderstood, or, you know, God knows what. Maybe you did nothing, you know, but you got it. You got a load of it, or whatever it was.
Well, I think it's roughly the same process if someone's really going off on you and expressing a lot of anger. It depends on who it is. You know, if it's a stranger, or you're the supervisor that I had the tantrum with, or whatever, I think that you have to, first of all, the training involved, if you're a social worker, a psychologist, a store manager, or whatever, you have to let it go through you without sticking. And I think the way that you do that is that you understand and identify with the pain that the person is having. If it's your job and you've committed yourself by taking such a job as a social worker or a teacher to helping people, that one thing they do, people who want help, is express their anger. Because they want help, they're not getting it. You know, as you said, there are many different reasons. You can be there, and it absolutely helps a person to be able to express it if it's expressed within certain bounds. Of course, if there's any violence involved, you remove yourself immediately and get help. I mean, nobody should put up with violence. And verbal abuse, you know, you have to decide what verbal abuse is. You know, if you feel abused, you have to say, stop there. It's fine for you to talk about why you're unhappy, but it's not okay for you to abuse me. You have to, again, be fluid enough, flexible enough to decide when someone's crossing the line. And for me, it takes place here. I'm very much in my body when someone's angry with me. I mean, I'm tremendously anxious to be the object of anger. But if I stay usually with that feeling, it will change. It will either get more intense, in which case I know to get out, or it will give way to some sort of empathy. And the other person can see that. This is why it's good to go into a situation, I mean, without a stance, because you're very, very sensitive to body language, to all sorts of cues in a situation if you don't have an idea of how this situation should end. Does that help? Well, it's never going to be easy to be the recipient of anger.
You have to remove yourself, like you said. Maybe that's it. You just remove yourself.
Well, sometimes when someone says to me, you know, I'm going to tell you how I feel about you. I mean, that kind of thing. I say, can I handle this? Can I take? I mean, I say to them, can I handle this? Are you going to tell me something I can handle? I mean, if I'm already feeling vulnerable, I'm not going to invite in just anybody. Oh, when you feel like meeting anger with anger? Well, not always. You don't always get in trouble if you meet anger with anger. I mean, I did in that instance where that man started hitting me. We didn't have the same idea of what the parameters were. but sometimes, you know, with a friend, for instance, boy, is that great, you know, to just shout at each other, to know while you're shouting that the friendship is solid. Well, you don't really know that completely, do you? Because if you're shouting at each other, you might damage it. So, and with spouses, spouses have to do this. I mean, they get on each other's nerves too much. So if you feel like you cannot participate in this, you should remove yourself. And that's your practice, asking yourself, what is so, in fact, that was part of my koan too. Why am I so, what was the word? So brittle. Why am I so brittle? My whole practice, that 7-year practice, started with a remark a friend made to me. And I said, I'm never going to speak to you again. And then I went home and thought, you know, I've had 15 years of Zen practice. What am I doing telling somebody I'm not going to ever speak to them again, especially a friend? And then that started me thinking, oh, I broke up with this boyfriend years ago when he said something that offended me, and he said, I can't believe you're breaking up with me over this. That's okay. Forget it. It's the end. So why am I so brittle? I mean, that night in my early 40s, I started seeing all that brittleness, all that inability to trust anyone after they'd hurt me. And that's why I started the practice. Does that help you at all? Maybe we should take another question, too, because it's getting late. When should I stop?
Around 9 o'clock.
Oh, okay. One more question. Yes.
That's so much a question. Comment. I was deeply struck when you mentioned the first idea of do no harm. I have never heard that concept to mean including yourself. And when you defined it and described it, you were essentially saying especially yourself. I found that.
Well, you have to take care of yourself or you'll be pretty angry. So, thank you very much. And I have brought two flyers, one for my book that I mentioned and another one for a workshop at Zen Center I'm giving this Saturday. And the flyers are out by the donation boxes. So thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to come here.